Then we can go right into the director's report.
Morning, Commissioners.
Morning, everybody.
Thanks for being here. I'm going to just cover a couple of topics this morning. As the chair mentioned, I'm going to talk about the recent harvest of a giant Pacific octopus along Alki Beach and some of the thoughts and responses that that we have. I'm going to also provide you an update on activities associated with our wolf conservation management plan. And I'm going to spend just a few minutes on our issue associated with the potential rule that would delist Stellar sea lions as a state-listed species. But before I start on any of that, I wanted to introduce a couple of new staff members that have recently joined the Department of Fish and Wildlife. First, Tim Burns is in the back of the room there, and he's our new assistant director for our capital assets management program, so taking the place of Bill Phillips. So we're really pleased to have Tim join us, and he's hit the ground running, particularly associated with implementing all of the projects associated with the jobs bill and the $65 million or so that the department received for a large number of projects.
Welcome.
And the second is Eric Gardner. And Eric just came on board this week, I believe. Eric comes to us from Arizona, and he is going to be the division chief for the biodiversity division in the wildlife program. So really happy to have Eric. He's got a great breadth of experience and knowledge to bring to that job and a lot of energy to bring to it, and so we're really excited to have Eric join us.
Welcome.
Give me a minute here, see if I can make this work. So there was a lot of attention given to a diver that legally harvested a giant Pacific octopus from a popular diving location off Alki Beach. Giant Pacific octopus are widely distributed in Puget Sound and are found in many different water depths. Had a chance to learn a little bit about the life history characteristics of this critter. They live, their lifespan's 3 to 5 years. In terms of weight, they range from 40 to 100 pounds, 12 to 15 feet in length. As most octopus are, they're pretty reclusive and spend 90% of their time hiding. The egg development in the females is takes place over about a 7-month period. Females lay between 20,000 and 100,000 eggs generally during the time frame of April and May. And they, the female brood their eggs for up to 230 days. And the other life history characteristic that I found interesting was they use 50% of the energy from the food they eat, whereas humans use about 10%. Sometimes I think I use about 5, but so a pretty impressive animal. So what you have up in front of you is the area known as the Seacrest Park Cove 2. This is a well-known urban park with water access along Alki Beach in West Seattle. The dive community uses this site for what they call checkout dives, graduation dives, to certify new divers as well. It's widely used for wildlife viewing and underwater photography. It has, I haven't had a chance to see it myself, but people tell me that it's got an elaborate underwater structures that support a variety of marine species, including rockfish, wolf eels, octopus, all which have been documented and the area has been mapped. Two parcels encompass the subtitle lands used for diving at this area. Both are owned by the city of Seattle. The most seaward parcel extends to water depths that are deeper than 100 feet. A recreational dive survey was conducted by Greg Bargman, an employee of the Department of Fish and Wildlife at the time, where it would have been the Department of Fisheries at the time, in the mid-80s. And observation was reported as the main purpose for recreational diving. This is a holistic across the state. And divers that promote that recreational activity, that 59% of the dives community, and those dives are for observational photography types of purposes. Consumptive activities of spearfishing and shellfishing accounted for 6% and 5% or so of the dives. An octopus was listed as one of the top six shellfish species important to recreational divers. There was another survey in 1991 by Gesselbrack, and they surveyed members of 22 dive clubs and reported similar results, with sightseeing representing 45% of the respondent dives, followed by spear fishing at 21%, and shellfish harvest at 20%, and underwater photography at 11%. So this was back in 1991, so things may have changed some.
Commissioner Jennings.
When queried.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are your percentages for this site or for diving?
No, this is
the whole.
The survey was not just specific to this site. No,
okay.
This is,
sure.
As I mentioned at the outset, this area, the area based on the information we have, is primarily used for observation, photography. It's used for sites for graduation dives and those types of activities. I'm giving you a broader perspective from the surveys.
Thank you.
That we're done. When queried about the sites that needed additional restrictions on harvest, the San Juan Islands received the highest number of nominations by respondents, followed by Titlow Beach, Tacoma Narrows, the Mukilteo area, and the West Seattle Alki Point area. There has been a considerable negative response from the public and from some portion to the dive community in response to the harvest of this animal from this area. We believe that this area merits consideration of additional harvest restrictions to enhance the traditional uses of this area that are not compatible with harvest activities of certain species. We have examined several different options to preserve giant Pacific octopus populations in this area. Some of those options include, in cooperation with the City of Seattle, begin a permanent rule process to consider establishing a non-consumptive wildlife viewing or marine protected area at Seacrest Park Cove 2 along Alki Beach. You may be aware that the Commission has a policy that was adopted in June of 1998 entitled Marine Protected Areas Within Puget Sound. And consistent with that policy, some of the objectives for establishing a marine protected area include providing non-consumptive recreational opportunities. We have a number of marine protected areas in Puget Sound. I believe there's 26 of them. They come with a range of restrictions from a harvest perspective. However, 23 out of the 26 marine protected areas do not allow harvest of shellfish within those marine protected areas. This information is all on our website as well as in our fishing pamphlet. But I went through all of the marine protected areas that we have and reviewed the harvest restrictions that are currently in place for those areas. This is just a graphic depiction of where these areas are located. So first, that first option would begin a permanent rule process to consider establishing a marine protected area in this particular area. The second option we looked at was prohibit the take or harassment of giant Pacific octopus that are nurturing eggs. I think the challenges associated with enforcement of such a regulation certainly would create some problems and challenges, but we did have some discussion about that. We also discussed prohibit the recreational. There is no commercial take on this. There's considered the approach to prohibit recreational take of giant Pacific octopus statewide. We also considered enacting an emergency rule that prohibits the harvest of giant Pacific octopus at Seacrest Park Cove while we pursue a permanent solution. And then, of course, there would be another alternative would be to take no action, status quo, or some combination of those things that I mentioned. And there may be others that we would identify other options as we went through a permanent rule process. So some of the analysis that we did in thinking about this is that first, as the landowner, the City of Seattle has the authority to prohibit access and to condition that access to this area. And from our Attorney General office, they also said that the city probably has the authority to prevent the landing of an octopus on a city-owned beach. As I mentioned, we've examined the potential of enacting an emergency rule to prohibit harvesting octopus in this area. We haven't, of course, under the Administrative Procedures Act, which is found under RCW 3405-350. It authorized agencies to adopt regulations via emergency rule if, for good cause, the agency finds that immediate adoption of the rule is necessary for the preservation of public health, safety, or general welfare, and that observing the ordinary time requirements for adoption of a permanent rule would be contrary to the public interest. So that's the sideboards that we have to stay within if we were going to use an emergency rule to address this issue. In our thinking and analysis, we believe the basis for an emergency rule is problematic in this instance, given that we do not have a conservation issue. We are not aware of a giant Pacific octopus harvest taking place in this area before. That's not to say it's never happened. But in talking with our Region 4 staff and our enforcement staff, they were not aware of this type of activity. And I think it's probably fair to say that this type of activity is generally discouraged, peer pressure, and that giant Pacific octopus are resilient and would re-inhabit this area quickly, according to our shellfish biologists that I've spoken with. We believe that immediately commencing a permanent rule process that would result in preserving the octopus population in this area and perhaps in a broader area is warranted. Such a proposed rule would be subject to the public rulemaking process, and a full discussion could be accommodated through that process. At this time, I do not intend to enact an emergency closure for this area in terms of the harvest of giant Pacific octopus. However, if another one were taken from this area, we would reconsider that decision. So that's my overview on the giant Pacific octopus issue. We would intend to begin a permanent rulemaking process, which is commences with the good old bureaucratic CR 101. So we would be able to have a discussion with our public, our constituents, the dive community, as we go through and develop alternatives before that we issue the CR 102, which has the specific regulations that would be considered by the commission. And so I would suspect that this process probably would extend over the next 6 months or so. So that is our intended approach. We intend to continue to monitor the situation. I'm anxious to hear what people have to say, because I know there's people sitting behind me that have a lot more expertise than I do in this area, and they have local knowledge, which I'll be interested to hear their thoughts. I'm now going to turn to stellar sea lions. Oh, if it's our questions. Sorry.
Commissioner Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Phil, just for my clarification, part of the rule process that will be undertaken is to explore a total state ban as well, right?
We believe our initial suite of options that we would like to discuss with the constituents would include that.
Okay.
As a potential.
Thank you.
Commissioner Jennings, you've got a few.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Barring a whole ceasing of recreational harvest, one of the options you didn't list was a season that would not include shorten the season from a year round to not on eggs. Hopefully that would be part of your range of alternatives to be considered. In discussions I've had with individuals, one of the concerns was, well, if we're just focusing on Cove 2, we could have them show up at Redondo or other common dive sites. So if we're going to be exploring closing common high visibility areas that are used primarily for non-consumptive uses, I would hope that we would look at including not just Cove 2, but also working with the dive community, identifying some other sites where we might want to close those other sites also to GPO harvest or other take. And as I think about it, if we're talking about spearfishing as an example, spearfishing in areas where we have lots of beginning divers with our low visibility doesn't always sound all that safe. So again, I think there's some basis for looking at other dives, other common dive sites in Puget Sound in addition to Cove 2. Thank you.
Okay, we're just taking in some comments now and questions because I forgot to mention, to point everyone's attention to the fact that this is a special meeting. It falls under the category of special meeting because we shifted our dates, and the dates were changed relatively recently to accommodate the election, but that meant that this meeting has to stick closely to the agenda. We can't be making any decisions on anything that we have not notified the public we are going to be considering. So we have the ability to talk about this in the context of the director's report, but we can't make any decisions until we've notified the public that we will be considering things. So Commissioner Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Anderson, I just have one, I guess, 30,000-foot question. As it relates to the population of Puget Sound-wide giant Pacific octopus, do we have the ability to know if it's trending in either direction, or is it fairly stable, or I guess do we know that?
I think it's fair to say that we don't have an absolute estimate of the abundance of giant Pacific octopus in Puget Sound. In talking with our dive team leader, Bob Sizemore, He said that he told me that they were widely distributed and are commonly found in Puget Sound. He didn't think that we had a conservation issue here. But in terms of a trend, in terms of the total abundance, in terms of numbers up or down, we don't have anything that would indicate that it is doing either.
Thank you.
Commissioner Mencken, did you have a question? Commissioner Jennings?
Comment and a question. One of the ways you find octopus when you're diving, I am a diver, is you look for the pile of Dungeness crab shells out in front of a hole. And with our strong Dungeness crab population, my sense is we probably have a fairly healthy GPO population, as opposed to a declining population. Although with all the endocrine disruptors and other toxins in the environment, you really can't assume just because you have a prey base, you have a healthy population. But my question is, do we have a sense of the magnitude of recreational harvest of giant Pacific octopus on an annual basis within Puget Sound? I would think that there's some, but I have no idea of the magnitude of that.
I did not ask that question of staff members that would be knowledgeable about that. I will do so, but I don't have an informed response to give you to that question.
Commissioner Schmitten.
Thank you, Chair. Along a similar vein, giving away my age, in the 80s, we actually permitted commercial octopus operations. Dungeness Spit used a box operation. Had a few permits. I assume they don't exist, and we don't authorize permits any longer for commercial octopus harvest.
I don't have specific knowledge about that, Commissioner Schmidt. No one in my haste to try to prepare for this today, in talking with fish program leadership, and as I mentioned, Bob Sizemore. I was not made aware of any commercial harvest allowance for this species.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to speak to David, Commissioner Jennings' comment. I, being a part of the recreational industry for many, many decades, and interact with recreational fishermen from all over the state, particularly Puget Sound, I truly don't know of any recreational harvest of octopus. I know of one I was told was brought to the boat by a gentleman fishing for lingcod one time, and it was released. It had grabbed hold of the herring. But I truly don't know of any. I just wanted to share that.
Okay. Commissioner Perry.
Yeah, this might not be a fair question to you, Director, but I wondered, how are they generally taken? I mean, if they're taken recreationally, is this a spearfishing target, or do they catch them in nets, or how are they generally taken?
I'm not an expert on that. I as Commissioner Carpenter mentioned, I've experienced catching one with a hook and line. Not targeting on octopus, but by accident, released it, by the way. Commissioner Jennings might be better prepared to answer specifically how, if a diver was going to target and harvest octopus, how that individual might do that.
Actually, I'd be sort of challenged to do it as a diver, and I was impressed at one level that the individual could get that octopus out of whatever crevasse it was in and get it to the surface. What I was going to say is, my understanding is, if you're actually targeting octopus from a fishing perspective, you're putting something like a vase down with a rope around it and letting it sit for 24 or 48 hours to see if they will actually occupy that space and then pull it up, as opposed to actually wrestling it up yourself. There are people that can wrestle them, but they have eight arms, they're pretty long, and it only takes, you know, two or three holding on to something to make it difficult to do. So.
Okay, on to stellar sea lions. So we are intending to begin a rulemaking process which, as you know, files starts with the filing of a CR 101, which is simply an indication and a public notice that we intend to look at the WACs, that the Washington Administrative Codes, the regulations that apply to the harvest of octopus, so as well as marine protected areas. Next one's I hope a little easier. Stellar sea lions, as you may remember, were awaiting a decision by National Marine Fisheries Service to delist stellar sea lions in the area in Washington, and that the southern portion of the stellar sea lion. And we had anticipated that action taking place and we had anticipated the timing, and so we had started in concert with that a consideration of delisting stellar sea lions from a state threatened and endangered perspective, and had started through the rulemaking process that would ultimately come to the commission for a decision. Shouldn't be surprised, I don't suppose, but National Marine Fisheries Service is delayed in making that decision, and as a result, our rulemaking needs to be modified. And so we will need to rearrange the delisting schedule in order to accommodate the potential that NMFS, National Marine Fisheries Service, may not announce their final decision on delisting until April of 2013. And so we want to make sure that we clearly sequence the review of the state status review and the following SEPA, State Environmental Protection Act, and rule adoption. So we have identified a new schedule that would have the commission available to take a final action on this in May of 2013. We could do that on a conference call, or perhaps it's a June meeting. Because of all the bureaucratic nature of the Administrative Procedures Act, however, and because we did file, again, that CR 102, and that CR 102 is a specific regulation change, and when you file a CR 102, there's also a rule adoption hearing provided, and because we are in the situation where the time period between the filing of the 102 and the 103, there's a maximum amount of time, I believe it's 180 days, and we're going to be beyond that by the time we get to May. So that means we had to redefine the schedule. We're going to have to withdraw the CR 102 that we have in place now, but from a procedural perspective, that 102 and the public, the rule adoption hearing associated with that rule needs to be provided for at this commission meeting. So my recommendation is that the commission accept testimony on the existing CR 102 during their open public comment period, if there's someone that came today to provide testimony on that CR 102, that you provide that opportunity.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Jennings.
I'm caught off guard, I guess. I didn't realize that, in fact, a CR 101 and 102 had been filed to delist at the state level the stellar sea lion. I don't think we've had a lot of discussion about that at the commission, previous commission hearings that I recall. I think that is a significant enough action that we actually have to have before May, a very clear presentation to the commission and a discussion about why we're doing it and what the options are, so we can clearly, so we can solicit whatever public input is appropriate before we make that decision, as opposed to saying the discussion, you know, allowing people to take comments today on that CR-102. My assumption would be that we'd have to have another CR-102 hearing for the amended or extended CR-102 piece.
Correct, Madam Chair, Commissioner Jennings. So we would completely withdraw this rule, this CR-102, and we'd essentially start over with the filing of a new CR-102 at the appropriate time when we have certainty that and can anticipate NIMS action. So associated with that, of course, would be a briefing with the commission and would be an opportunity for the public to comment on that rule action prior to taking any action.
Thank you.
So I'm going to move on to our wolf activity update. And I just putting a slide up here just to have you, so you have something to look at when I'm talking. So let me just start with remote camera surveys. Our efforts in this area have slowed down as we transition to our winter surveys. However, we are continuing to monitor remote cameras in a few key areas of the state. The Wedge area is one of those areas we are continuing to monitor, and we have not detected wolves in the Wedge based on remote cameras and roadside track surveys following recent snow events in that area. Wolf sightings. In terms of new wolf activity, we're following up on leads in several areas, including the area that surrounds the Wedge. For those of you who wonder where the Wedge is, it's up above Boulder Creek. Well, you can see the Wedge, sorry, up there. It's about 35 miles north of the southern portion. It's about 35 miles north of Colville. So we're following up on some leads in several areas around the Wedge, a few areas in the Blue Mountains, and a few leads on the west side. But we haven't had any wolf confirmations in these areas yet. Relative to recent reported wolf depredation incidents, we had, you may recall from the October 17th Wolf Weekly report that one of our biologists, Jay Shepard, and our enforcement officer, Don Weatherman, and Stevens County Sheriff's Sheriff Allen and Stevens County Captain Harbolt investigated the scene of a deceased bovine that was within the Smackout pack territory. Smackout wolf locations were in the field where the carcass was found, and scavenging by Smackout wolves was evident, but the time between the carcass discovery and death was long enough that the cause of death was unknown. Jay Shepard, Don Weatherman, and our regional enforcement captain, Dan Ron, visited the site after the local press reported that the steer was a confirmed wolf kill. No evidence to support this was found in the subsequent site visit. Staff followed up on this incident by meeting and talking about wolf issues with cattle producers Jeff Dawson, Myrna, Kyra, and Brent Olson, who all have cattle in the Rocky Creek area of the Aladdin Valley. From the October 31st our weekly report, Officer Dan Anderson took a report from a Black Canyon Road property owner who observed what she believed to be a wolf carrying off her chicken. Investigations provided no substantive supporting evidence that this was a wolf, although this is reasonably close to where the Smackout pack is located. On November 7th, District 1 staff were called to a possible depredation in the vicinity of the Smackout wolf pack. The cattle owner indicated that the cattle were alarmed and observed running several nights prior to this date. On this date, November 7th, staff located a 1,200-pound dead cow in the creek bottom of the owner's property without apparent external signs of a predator attack. However, the carcass could not be moved without machinery, and a necropsy could not be completed. Fladry has been placed to protect the carcass until it can be removed from the creek, and the removal of the carcass is expected to occur tomorrow. Change in topics or areas of topics here. The winter survey. Staff started the winter survey work to estimate pack size and packs that meet the successful breeding pair. Remembering that's the definition for that is that at least two surviving pups by the end of December. That work is expected to continue through the first of the year with a final report being available in March. One of our trappers and camera experts, Jeff Flood, recently obtained a remote camera picture of 7 wolves in the diamond pack. And I think I can show you, it's kind of there's a better picture here. So, let's see here. I can do this. You can look and see. There's a set of eyes. Another one there. And then this guy that's right up front. And looking at the hoof of the animal here, that looks like a deer, but I'm not sure of that. But anyway, kind of a. This was taken six. This date is wrong on the camera. This was taken 6 days ago. So kind of an interesting shot. Picture, I mean. So I'm going to take that off there so you'll listen to me and not look at that picture all the time. So in terms of agreements, you know that we've been seeking to pursue agreements with livestock producers, and the purposes of the agreements is to lay out non-lethal tools that the producers agree to carry out, as well as cost-share programs for equipment or staff, such as range riders, and potential compensation for impacts to livestock beyond those that are confirmed or probable. We've made some progress in that area. We're also looking at a different approach that doesn't require the livestock owner to sign an agreement form, but instead goes through a checkoff list. So, okay, here's the checklist of things that you will do, and they agree verbally to that checkoff list. We share that checkoff list, but it doesn't require a signature, which is in some places the livestock owners are reluctant to sign the document. So we're trying to figure out a way to get to the same positive endpoint without having that be a part. In terms of staffing, we have a new position. We're preparing to announce for a new wildlife conflict position in Northeast Washington. We currently have two of those positions located in Region 3 that focus on ungulate damage issues. This new position is critical for us to meet the growing needs with wolf conflicts in Northeast Washington, and will also take some of the pressure off, particularly enforcement staff that are dealing with those issues. The depredation investigation protocols, we're in the process of revising those depredation protocols. The purpose is to evaluate how the draft protocol worked over this last summer and make appropriate improvements. One item that's being addressed is evaluating the level of certainty in the evidence when making a determination on an incident. Again, this is work that we're going to be doing over the winter, and expect to have a final by March. In the area of training, we're also preparing several wolf-related internal training sessions for later this in November, the last week of November. Training sessions will focus on wolf ecology, outreach, education, tools for minimizing wolf-livestock conflict, and depredation investigation training. We continue to try to make progress with our Northeast Livestock Team and Stakeholder Group. This has been a real challenge for us and continues to be. We recently received a letter from Stevens County Cattlemen's Association President that was certainly an illustration of the difficulty we're having coordinating our activities and working with folks. On a positive side, there are, again, a number of livestock operators up there where we've been working with them on a one-on-one basis that we're finding more success. As Commissioner Caney mentioned, this nonprofit called Blackfoot Challenge, they're primarily working up in the Ovando area north of Missoula. And as the commissioner mentioned, I, along with Commissioner Caney, Dave Ware, Nate Pamplin, got a chance to go up there and spend an afternoon with two commissioners, including the chair of the Montana Fish and Wildlife and Parks Commission, and three of the staff from the agency. Had a real good conversation about experiences, sharing approaches. They also shared with us kind of a public opinion survey they did for tolerance or lack thereof of wolves on the landscape in Montana. And maybe not surprisingly, it looks different in Montana than it does here. The degree of intolerance is higher there than it is here. A couple of observations. There's a number of them, but one is the Animal Wildlife Services, which is associated with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, does all the livestock depredation investigations in Montana. The Montana Fish Wildlife staff do not do that, and they also I would say have a more aggressive lethal removal program and response than what we have contemplated here. And Wildlife Services does all of the lethal removal. So again, Montana Fish and Wildlife staff are not involved. Now,
Commissioner Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Are they under contract and using state dollars to pay for the wildlife services, or is that the federal agency doing it gratis, I guess?
My understanding is the state is not providing funding to wildlife services for doing that work. They're getting federal funding. USDA and Wildlife Services is funded at a much higher level in Montana than it is in Washington. So even if we thought that looked like a good idea, we would have to figure out a way to work with them, to find some funding in order for that to occur. They actively promote non-lethal measures, and we had an opportunity to visit a couple of ranches, two ranches in one area where there's allotment grazing in areas that are there's some difficult terrain, and there's timbered area, but it doesn't compare to the type of environment that we have in the Wedge. And they do have range rider, and we did have an opportunity to have a range rider as a part of our group and talked with him quite a little bit. They transition to lethal removal quickly if they have a depredation. and I mean quickly, they try to get the offending to the best of their ability, obviously not knowing specifically, but they try to get the offending animal removed so it doesn't perpetuate that activity or that habit within the pack. And when you look at the number of depredations, the events that they have had over time, and you look at the growth in the wolf population in the state, it appears that the cumulative effect of the various activities that they're undertaking appears to be pretty successful in terms of, even though the wolf population has been going on, the depredation events have remained stable or even gone down a little bit. One other piece that I'll just, we looked at, one of the ranchers had developed a fencing, fladry with fencing device that essentially was a spool that was driven by an electric motor. They had a trailer with a generator on it, and so they were able to deploy the electric or the fladry fencing around an area off a spool pretty effectively, and they had special fence posts, metal fence posts that they used, and then they all also had it where they could just wind it up. And so it was pretty inventive, but it certainly could be duplicated. It's not that, sophisticated of a device. But and then the other piece, the other thing that they had done is they don't have any areas on ranches where, you have in a livestock operation, you've got animals, they die. You have some losses. And the traditional method has been to have a depository where you go put all those animals. And that can cause, of course, other animals to come and feed off those. And, gee, that beef tastes pretty good. So they have worked with the ranchers, and the ranchers are actually putting some money, not all of it, but they're putting some money toward having a truck that goes around and makes the rounds and collects dead animals. They have an agreement with the Department of Transportation. The Department of Transportation then, as they collect road kills, particularly deer, they have a place where they're composting all of that. There's a big pile of compost. So they don't have any bone yards or areas on ranches where they're having dead animals be deposited. So that was another area that I thought was a pretty impressive cooperative project that looked like it had some good results. So overall, just it was a good learning experience, and really happy that I had an opportunity to go there and spend some time with their commissioners as well. So I'm almost done. Quickly finish up. So just some other areas of maybe items of interest with wolves. The Washington Association of Conservation Districts is having their meeting. Steve Pazanger and Dave were attending that in late November. The Washington Cattlemen's Convention is going on this week, and Dave Ware's over there today. Conservation Northwest had a Living with Wolves, which had a public presentation and panel discussion up at the University of Washington that Donnie Martorello attended last week. We've got public disclosure requests that are just really onerous coming from a lot of different places that staff are spending a lot of time on. We also held an all staff meeting, engaged in the wolf issue, wolf work over in Spokane Tuesday of this week. I went over there and we had about 30 people. So we had all our Olympia folks, our regional folks from different regions over there talking about communication improvements, both internal and external. our winter spring field work planning, non-lethal equipment needs, training, those types of things, lethal removal protocols, going back and looking at those again, and just a real download of the events and decisions surrounding the wedge pack. We had a real lively discussion about that, and there was I don't know that I was surprised, but we had a real a lot of different perspectives on how it worked and how it didn't work, and what we learned and what we could do better next time, and so that was a valuable thing for me. And then lastly, Senator Ranker is planning to have a hearing, and we understand it will be in January. We have originally thought that maybe it was going to be during committee week, the last week of November, but as it turns out, it'll be in January. So I'll stop there.
Okay. Commissioner Carpenter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions, Director Anderson. In your meetings with the Montana Coalition, was there any discussion about the trends of ungulate populations in that area? And the second question, just to get it on the table, the Senator Ranker hearing, do we know the dates of that in January approximately, so we can, I know there's a bunch of other meetings, our meetings, the PF, Pacific Salmon Commission meetings, would we be able to nail that down anytime in the near future?
On the first question, I believe they have 26 elk herds in Montana. This particular area that we were in has elk and has deer. We encountered a number of hunters as we were going up into this one particular area. All I can say, we didn't talk about the population of deer and elk in that particular area other than the one individual that we had from Montana Fish and Wildlife that was with us at that time said the populations seemed to be healthy and that hunter success had been pretty good. The other thing, though, that they have there is grizzly bears. And the third rancher we met with, and they had created some fencing, some five-strand electric fencing that they had used to deter grizzly bears, and I found it kind of amazing that this fencing had been very effective in preventing grizzly bear intrusion into their calving areas that were surrounded by this fencing. And there was some hope that this fencing would also be effective at keeping wolves out of that area. And where we were standing at the time where this fencing was, I mean, it was a short look across a riparian area, and up on that hillside, it was a known area of a wolf pack. But the grizzly bears on, I think it was to the west of us as we were standing there, that there were a number of grizzly bears in that area too, and I mean, they had been dealing with grizzly bears longer than they'd been dealing with wolves. So, and on the date, the date hasn't been set yet. I'm going to guess it's going to be after the new session starts and the new governor is in and makes his inaugural address, which I think the change of power is at 12:01 noon on January 16th, so I think it'll be after that date would be my guess.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Schmitten?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Director. I very much appreciate you keeping us current on the WIF issue. You indicated that Montana is very aggressive in their lethal removal of offending animals, assumed killing livestock. Did you talk at all about their methods of removal?
Yes. Helicopters are the most effective. They don't hesitate to use them. In this one area that we were standing in an area that was surrounded by timber, but there was a large grassy meadow area that we were standing in, and looking up on the hillside was an area where their cattle allotment and grazing was, and they referenced that right over there was a livestock depredation, and that they I mean, the advantage they had in this area is that there's the area, the undergrowth, the cover in the area is such that finding a carcass, I think, is easier, quite a bit easier than it would be in the area in the wedge. And so the minute they find that, they stake that out, and the next day they wait for the animals to come back to scavenge on the carcass, and they take the animals. The ones that come back to that the next day, they remove them. But it puts them in a, I mean, the positive side is that you're not, if you do that, the chances of getting into a situation where you have to remove the entire pack goes down. And so they're able to keep the pack there, but the individuals, that the minute they see a member or two of that pack start with this kind of activity, they remove them. And so, I mean, their feeling is that it's a benefit to their wolf recovery and to having an environment where wolves are able to live in areas where there's cattle without conflict.
Commissioner Kenny was next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add to what Phil's saying, and it was a very positive trip, and when we talk about the immediate lethal removal, you mentioned it. It was in the effort to avoid a total pack removal, and that quick response was so important to not have that learning process take place in the whole pack. Also, that having done that, there leading up to that, there was really good communication, I think, and that was a highlight for me, was on the collared wolves and the location that the range riders that were working in the Blackfoot Challenge knew for most parts where the wolves were, if they were in any proximity to the cattle population, and put themselves between cattle and wolves daily was really important. And the communication of that location data, I think I learned some things there. It has to happen on a regular basis, and it has to build this trust relationship with ranchers and the data, but they need it. And I remember the several ranchers saying, you know, just the peace of mind of knowing where the wolves were and that there was someone out there watching for them gave them the ability to go back and do their normal ranch chores. And the way they were handling it a lot of times was wait for that call that you could have a problem, they're in close proximity, send some people up here and let's get together. When that happened, typically they brought in more people, either from the ranching community, the nonprofit community, and tried to cause, not have the depredations to occur. And in I guess support of what we heard over there, even though they moved quickly to lethal if necessary, I think the numbers were about 1.5 million acres the Blackfoot Challenge was working in. They have on an average over the last 4 or 5 years an average of about 3 proven confirmed depredations, and in turn about 3 the need to take out about 3 wolves per year as well. So they're, something's working right, and I think that's why I was encouraged in listening to them that some of those techniques, not all of them, but some of them might be applied in our state and help bring those numbers down.
I think the other thing that struck me was they don't use GPS collars. They don't put a lot of their resources into collaring packs. And so they're, you know, you need to get within range and have with the telemetry equipment to detect where the wolf, a collared wolf, is. They're not doing what we're doing, and they have a remarkably few number of packs that have collars. I can't remember. I think they had 2, and the other one was the sharing of the data. I think that's the other one takeaway for me was, if you got a collared animal, you've got somebody that's willing to work with you with range riders, you give them the data, every bit of it, and so that you can put them in a position where they've got the best chance of being successful.
Mr. Perry?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to emphasize that also. I deal with a lot of ranchers, and I think that data sharing and communication with them through the department is extremely important also. And I think that also would generate a lot more mutual respect, I think, particularly in the rancher community. But I did want to ask a question also. In your trip there and your discussions, did you talk about hunting and how hunting affected the wolf population in that area that you visited, both relative to their expansion, to livestock depredation, maybe to game animals as well? Does hunting have any impact at all?
Yes, we did talk about that, and I believe that they felt that hunting and keeping wolf helped keep wolf populations down at a level where there can be compatibility with wolves being on the landscape and have successfully with cattle. I mean, it was one of the tools. It was, and I don't know that they said this specifically, but without that, I think they felt like the potential for conflict would be higher. So the ability to, the impact of hunting just in terms of reducing the absolute total number of wolves on the landscape, as well as having interaction, you know, with, in a negative way, with human presence and wolves was a benefit.
I had one more question. Did you discuss the Wildlife Management Services taking care of the depredation and the other things that you discussed? How is Montana handling the budget impact of wolves?
I asked the first day that we were there how many dedicated staff Montana Fish and Wildlife and Parks had to wolves, and the answer was 6 FTEs. And that was a surprise. I thought they would have a much higher number, I walked, while the Blackfoot Challenge initiative, that nonprofit and this cooperative approach that they have in that area, I think that it's a unique example. It's not a common example of what's going on in Montana. It's a unique example. And the other thing that you clearly see from the hunting, if you have a map of Montana and the areas where they have wolves, it's in the western quarter of the state. I mean, there's an occasional harvest of a wolf in the other, but it is in the westernmost portion of that state where they've got the animals. So resources, they have wolf a license fee that they're able to put toward management, and I don't remember the number of hunting wolf permits that they had sold, but it was a lot. So number one, that they don't, they're not putting a lot, if they've got 6 dedicated staff, they're not putting a lot of resources toward it, and Wildlife Services is funded so well to do all the depredation investigations and do the lethal removals that the burden on the agency is a lot less than it is to us right now.
Thank you.
Commissioner Jennings?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a process question or point. We had the public testimony scheduled for 8:45. People have taken time off from work to be here. We haven't yet heard about budget and operations. My suggestion is we actually, when we conclude the wolf discussion, break, let take public comment, and then come back and wrap up the budget discussion afterwards.
Sounds very sensible. Thanks. So let's turn it over to Deputy Director Storr. Did you have a budget presentation for us? Or?
I'm just suggesting that we postpone that till after public comment.
Oh, okay.
That's fine.
Was it going to be short, or?
Well, I've got maybe 5 minutes.
Five minutes?
It's not counting our questions. Is what I'm just looking at the clock, and yeah. We were supposed to be done with public comment at this point. You're the chair. I'm just making
a suggestion. Yeah. Can you all bear with us for 5 more minutes? Okay. Deputy Director Storr, let's make this quick.
Great. Thanks, Commissioners. Good morning. I've got just 2 issues. In front of you is a copy of a transition document. This is a document that the governor asked us to put together and gave us a format for. The intent is to compile a set of useful briefs for the new incoming governor. And so the document discusses the agency, our organizational structure, our budget, and then what are called hot topics. These are the areas that the new governor will probably need to make decisions in during the first 3 to 6 months of his entry into that role. And you'll see that we identified 4 different decisions, pending sets of decisions that the governor may be called on to address. Wolves, the Oregon initiative on the Columbia River, commission appointments, and land acquisition. So I just wanted you to know what we're conveying to the governor's office in terms of those issues that may come forward from Fish and Wildlife. Second topic has to do with the state budget. As you know, this is the 5th legislative session we're about to enter with budget challenges. It's different this time around in a lot of ways because in the past we've had months essentially to prepare. We were asked to do various reduction scenarios on our general fund and talk about what that might mean. We haven't been asked that this time. So anticipating that once the new governor is on board and the legislature convenes, that there's going to be a lot of activity around a budget challenge that's at least as great, probably greater than the last couple of years. Remember, the September forecast projected at the end of next biennium a $1.2 billion shortfall in general funds. And on top of that, another huge challenge with the Supreme Court decision around K-12 education. That $1.2 billion assumes that the 3% pay cut that state employees took comes back to the employees. It assumes that the initiative around K-12 class size is addressed, both actions that didn't take place this last supplemental budget. So as we begin to look at the budget, we'll first look at the November forecast, which takes place next week. And word on the street is that it's probably about status quo, maybe a slight bit worse. Not better. And then the governor's budget comes out in mid-December, so we'll get a sense as to how she's proposing to address those huge challenges. I believe, though, we'll see a what's called a book one budget, an all cuts budget to get to a balanced situation. And then she's announced that she's looking at new revenue sources, potentially for the education issue around the McCleary decision. So expect to gear up pretty quickly around budget and get more clarity as to what folks are thinking. It's been kind of an odd year knowing that this black cloud is sort of looming out there. So with that, I'll close.
Commissioner Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, sticking with the potential reductions in general fund, state funds, the department has done some identification of possible reductions in past years that I would expect to be brought back to the table
to evaluate the ones that were not taken in the past. It would look at those to come up with what might be seen as a reduction. I guess I'm curious about the process with the compressed timeline of how the department will be working with the commission to determine what budget reductions will be pushed forward to OFM and the governor's office.
Thanks, Commissioner Jennings. As in the past, whatever you would like us to do as a commission, be happy to do that. Remember that the general fund we have remaining, we've over those 5 years gone from $110 million in state general fund down to 58 currently. That 58 million sits in three buckets. Our fish management is the largest percentage. So that includes fish recovery, fish production, and then the monitoring and management in the field. The second major use of general funds is our enforcement officers, and the third has to do with our habitat protection program. So when we're asked to make a general fund reduction, you have three choices, and they're all tough. But I'd be happy to work with the commission any way you like. It will be a compressed time frame.
Okay.
And just the budget oversight, fiduciary responsibilities is a major part of the commission's responsibilities, and that's why I'm just wanting to make sure that we're engaged in what goes from us to the governor's office.
I'd appreciate some, maybe not now, but some clarity about that.
Okay. Come up with some proposals. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thanks, Director, Deputy Director.